I'll just introduce our speaker today, Carl Jackson. Carl is the former Environment Officer for the National Union of Students, and he's been involved in the Stop Adani campaign up in Queensland. So please make him welcome.
Carl. So, as Matt Canavan would insist, beautiful, Carl. Saw that in the news the other day. Now, just over a year ago in the Australian Parliament, Scott Morrison whipped out a piece of coal just like this, railing against something he's generously given us a new word for, coalophobia. Now, ScoMo tells us not to be afraid of coal. Coal is your friend. Well, I wonder if he could look Steve Mellor in the face. Steve, just 39 years old, up in the Queensland coalfields, who just a couple of years ago was diagnosed with untreatable black lung disease. And he's one of an estimated over 1,000 coal miners, mostly young, who have contracted the disease. I wonder if Morrison could look into the faces of the workers and their families in the Latrobe Valley, living close to the Hazelwood coal mine, which in 2014 burned uncontrollably for 45 days, thanks to company negligence. The burning mine spewed pillars of carcinogenic smoke into the air that resulted in not just the worst natural disaster, but arguably the worst public health disaster Victoria has ever seen. And I wonder if he could gaze into the eyes of Dennis Gabuma, an elder of Boigu in the Torres Strait Islands, who last year told The Guardian of the effects of rising sea levels produced by climate change on his ancestral homeland. Roads and buildings washing into the sea, even their cemetery inundated by the creeping waterline, all while the Australian government stymies his people's demands for help, leaving many to now talk about evacuation. So I don't have time to personalise all the tragedies and destruction wrought by this senseless yet incessant extracting and burning of this commodity coal, but there are many. But there's a reason that people like Scott Morrison know no fear of this seemingly innocuous black rock, and that's because he represents a class of people in this country who have built and maintained literal empires from mining and burning the stuff, and who also conveniently have the financial freedom to escape or mitigate the dangers it creates. The working class, however, we're not so lucky. But what can we do about it? Well, the most obvious reason to schedule this talk at Marxism this year is that because, you know, for the first time in a long time, we've seen the emergence of a large, truly national environmental campaign in this country, Stop Adani, and I'm going to, like, say my 2 cents on that towards the end of my talk. However, I think it's also important to situate the fight against that one mine in a broader context, because the truth is, even if we manage to stop the Adani mine, that still won't ensure fossil fuels are left in the ground to rest once and for all. And that's because the agenda that's driving the Adani coal mine is much, much bigger than just that one coal pit. Our capitalist class have big plans to develop the north of Australia, and a substantial part of that includes building many more big, dirty coal mines. And Adani's is simply the springboard. And if you just look at the Galilee Basin, the Carmichael mine is just one of 9 proposed mines for that region. But first, I want to start off by trying to convey the scale and the depth of the problem of coal. So coal is really one of the key commodities of Australian capitalism. While eclipsed by China and the United States in terms of overall production and consumption, Australia is undisputably number one when it comes to coal exports. So we export something like 38% of global coal exports. For comparison, the second biggest exporter, Indonesia, accounts for a mere 17%, Russia, 12%, and the United States, 6%. So in other words, Australia exported more coal than the next 3 countries combined. To compare with our other top exports, coal is second only to iron ore and double the next most valuable export, international education. A huge 75% of all the coal mined in Australia is destined for export, mostly to Japan, China, and a bunch of other Southeast Asian countries, while the remainder is used for domestic electricity generation. And where does the coal come from in Australia? Well, it mostly comes from Queensland, significantly in the Bowen Basin, where the Adani mine is slated to be built. And it's the source of a significant portion of the world's coking coal, which is necessary for the production of steel. The remainder of the coal mined in Australia is thermal coal, like this stuff here, which is what people are most familiar with, which is what we use to generate electricity. And outside of Queensland, which is also where the majority of thermal coal deposits lie, there's large pockets in New South Wales, South Australia, WA, and here in Victoria, although the latter produces only mostly like lower-grade brown coal. Okay, so that's a bit about the coal industry. I just wanted to briefly talk about like the domestic energy market as well. So yeah, not only do we export a lot of it, we burn a lot of it here too. The remainder of coal used for domestic electricity generation makes up a huge 73% of all electricity generated in Australia, the other 27% being split almost equally between natural gas and renewables. Well, once it was the state governments that own and control Australia's electricity grids, from the power stations to the poles and wires, by the 90s, privatisation began to set in with the creation of the national electricity market, which separated generation from transmission, distribution and retail. By the early 2000s, Victoria and South Australia had fully privatised their networks, and today most have been at least partially privatised, where the network and some generation remain state-owned, while retail and all the rest has been totally privatised. And so, of course, for working-class people like us, this has led not just to massive energy bill increases across the board, but deteriorating networks, massive power failures, which people might have seen recently in South Australia, Victoria and Tasmania. Okay. So now that I've talked a bit about, what the industry looks like and the energy market, I just wanted to talk about, I think this is really important, which is to understand the impact that the mining boom, the most recent mining booms had on the Australian economy. So driven by rapid Chinese industrialisation, the resources and energy boom of this century has produced the most significant structural change to Australian capitalism in recent times, much like every boom that's gone before it. So most significantly, the 1850s, you know, gold rushes, the 1960s mining boom, etc. The latest one began around 2003, when international demand and therefore commodity prices began to rise sharply. And by 2011, large amounts of investment were taking place to construct large new mining and resources projects. And just one example is the Chevron's Gorgon project over in WA, which cost $70 billion just to construct. It's taken years and years to build it, and it's only just about to come online. And so by about 2014, many of these mining and resources projects began to come online as well. And the mining boom has made huge fortunes for the owners and executives in charge of these companies, seen in the fact that the three mining companies in the ASX's top 20 listed companies hold between them almost 17% of total market value. In Australia, mining has the highest profit margin of any industry at 37.1%, and the average profit margin for all industries in Australia is only 11%, so that gives you an indication of how much they're raking in. And just in the last financial year, in 2017 to 18, so this is projected, but they reckon that the mining sector is going to make something like $214 billion. So it's pretty rosy for the mining barons. However, there have been a couple of contradictions and problems born out of this mining boom. And so the first one is that it's been incredibly capital intensive. In other words, huge amounts of investment in construction and large-scale machinery is required just to set these projects up. So they create an initial burst of economic activity. However, by the time they're operational, very little labour is required to keep them going. So while during the construction phase of the boom from 2011 to 2014, there was a surge of jobs, these have largely receded. And today, although most people think of mining as this like huge section of the Australian economy, it employs less than 2% of the workforce, which is quite incredible. Secondly, the boom has produced a really lopsided economy, heavily weighted towards mining, while little else has gone forward. So at the height of the investment boom, the Australian dollar soared, causing sections of the economy like tourism and agriculture, which benefit from a lower Australian dollar, to suffer. While the dollar has fallen back since then as commodity prices fell from record highs, it's still higher than other sections of the capitalist class would like. So manufacturing has obviously taken a massive backward slide, with most of the major manufacturing plants and also steelworks offshoring operations. While some industries that service the mining sector have sprung up, these have still not been sufficient to replace the hole that's been left by the receding of manufacturing. With nearly half of all Australian export earnings coming from mining and resources, this leaves the Australian economy as a whole extremely vulnerable should international commodity prices for like iron ore, coal, LNG, etc. Suddenly head south. And so, yeah, people might remember back in 2010, the Rudd government tried to address this lopsidedness through the introduction of like a super profits tax on the mining companies. And that revenue was meant to be directed to help out the capitalists in the flailing industries like manufacturing. However, the mining bosses got together with all of their money and their influence and they managed to topple Rudd, and that didn't happen. So, a picture of Australian capitalism today. It's doing very well compared to the rest of the global economy. We're in like our 27th year of consecutive growth. That's like a world record. And we've had this massive expansion of mining. However, the construction phase has ended, so a lot of that initial economic activity is starting to diminish. And there's a whole bunch of weaknesses, like with the lack of diversity in the economy. And if like global coal prices were suddenly to go through the floor, the Australian economy would be in a lot of trouble. All right, so what is the ruling class's strategy from here on? Obviously, we want to see a society free of coal. We don't want any more of the stuff dug up. We want a 100% renewable energy economy. But I think we like need to separate a couple of things out. On the one hand, we've got like domestic energy use, like how electricity is generated in Australia, and then you have exports. Because there's actually a debate that's been raging amongst the Australian capitalists for some time. I mean, you see this recently with Elon Musk's publicity stunt in South Australia, building the world's largest lithium battery there. And that kind of technology shows that we could have renewable energy on a mass scale. The cost of producing solar cells and this kind of thing has been massively dropping in recent years. So there's some capitalists who actually say we could transition to renewable energy. We could actually still make heaps of profits out of this, selling electricity to working class people. But then, of course, you've got all the capitalists who have their fingers in all the pie because they own all of the, now mostly privatised assets and stuff, for coal-fired power. So I personally think, and there's some compelling, I encourage people to go and read Ross Garnaut's recent climate change review. He's an economist at the University of Melbourne. And back in 2008, he basically said that he still didn't think that Australia could transition to 100% renewable energy. However, he recently did a revision of that review in 2016. And he reckons now, because of the falling cost of producing like photovoltaic cells, etc., and battery technology and that kind of thing, but also because the cost of gas, which a lot of the capitalists in Australia had seen as perhaps an alternative energy source other than coal, gas prices in Australia have recently gone through the roof, and that's because instead of using it here, we're exporting it all to places like Japan. And so that means if you want to buy gas in Australia, very, very expensive. So he reckons that for Australia at least, you could actually see, the ruling class could actually start to shift towards renewable energy. However, I think that that does not mean anything about like stopping digging up coal, because as I said at the beginning, 75% of the coal that we dig up is exported. And it makes hundreds of billions of dollars for the capitalists every year. So that is why I do not think, even if, and I still think it would take a massive struggle to move to renewable energy. Like I said, like think of all the companies who own everything from electricity generators to parts of like the grid. Even if we manage to have a fight against them and move to 100% renewable energy, they're going to keep digging up this coal to ship it all around the world to make profits. Alrighty. And there's an added dimension to this as well of international economic and even military competition. So hear me out. So despite its relatively small population, Australia is a high-performing economy, which, as we went through before, has punched above its weight all through the global financial crisis, mostly thanks to its enormous reserves of natural resources. However, there are many other countries vying for a greater share of export markets, and Australian capitalism needs to constantly improve. It is to hope to stay ahead. But it's not just economic competition that's been heating up recently, but also growing imperialist rivalry as well, particularly in our corner of the world, where the rise of China has upset US hegemony in the region. There's a new arms race all across Southeast Asia. There's been spats over land, like China's contested claim to the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, the contestation of large reserves of oil and gas in the Sea of Japan, and of course, the Indonesia's military occupation of West Papua for mineral wealth. So if Australia is going to try and maintain its superior economic position, by necessity, it needs to advance its military power as well. And conversely, its ability to do that is contingent on having a strong economy. Therefore, at this juncture, the Australian ruling class cannot afford a misstep which might suddenly force them to fall behind their competitors. And unfortunately for us, the massive amounts of investment and time and lost profit that would be required to move away from mining coal would cause Australia to lose a considerable amount of its competitive edge, meaning it is not an attractive option for the Australian state. And if you don't believe me, I also really encourage people to go and read the federal government's white paper from 2015 called Our North, Our Future, which speaks quite explicitly about the need for Australia to play to its strengths by expanding mining into the north of the continent, which possesses in excess of 60% of Australia's economically demonstrated black coal reserves. And it also talks about the growing importance of Asian markets and, yeah, the need for, like, greater security on the northern tract of the continent and that kind of thing. So, yeah, read that document and you'll see that they have big plans. And I think that the Adani mine is just like it's the key that unlocks something much, much bigger. Okay. To be honest, though, like the coal barons, they're not a really clever lot. They're not really that forward-thinking. They don't think about, you know, strategic interests of Australian capitalism and global markets and that kind of thing. Actually, it's the state that does that. And I think possibly there's been a talk this weekend on, like, the capital state, but I don't know. It's a pretty important part of Marxist theory. But, yeah, I think if something that really gives you a sense of the iron commitment to coal in Australia is the fact that the industry is back to the hilt by every level of the state today. So even from the local council level, we had Townsville City Council recently in Queensland. They laid off about 150 workers, but then they were able to go and gift $30 million to Adani to build an airstrip for it to service its mine, if it goes ahead. At the state level, it was the Bligh Labor government which set all the plans in train to develop the Galilee Basin back in 2010. And subsequent Liberal and Labor governments, which have granted the miner unlimited water use licences, generous land clearing, they expanded and sold off part of the Abbott Point coal terminal. They rubber stamped the dredging of the Great Barrier Reef. They've granted royalty-free periods worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Adani. And, of course, signed off on generous government loans. In Queensland, the mining industry garners about $1.4 billion per year in state government subsidies and tax concessions, and it's been $10 billion just over the last decade alone in Queensland. And Australia-wide, the figure for coal subsidies is something like $4.5 billion a year. As for the federal government, well, they've created a whole raft of financial instruments, like people might have heard of the NAIF, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund. And there's a new one, the Export Finances and Insurance Corporation, or EFIC, to pump free money in the industry to keep it afloat. Notably, if one of these fails, which is extremely unlikely given how opaque and undemocratic they are, like NAIF isn't even obliged to disclose who's applying for loans, and they don't need to even tell us until 3 months after they've given one, and they've got $5 billion to give out of free money, they can simply create another one. And so the EFIC, I don't know if people have heard about it, but it was kind of lying dormant for a long, long time. It had a very small budget. And then recently Christopher Pyne said, oh, hang on, we'll give you like billions of dollars. And that's how he has given $3.8 billion to the arms manufacturing industry. But actually, if you look at the way that EFIC is structured, they could easily use this to give money for free to coal companies. And they would not even be beholden to any sort of environmental protections or anything like that. The flow of subsidy money from government to industry is further lubricated by the fact that many a former resources minister ends up on the company boards or as spokespeople for the industry. So I'm talking about people like Labor's Martin Ferguson, who sits on the board of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, amongst quite a few others, and has his own commercial interests in the sector. Ian McFarlane, the former Liberal Minister, who's currently the Chief Executive Officer of the Queensland Resources Council, and also for the former Queensland Labor Treasurer, Keith DeLacy, who has chaired just a stunning number of boards for fossil fuel companies. People should go check it out. Yeah. And if you look at other wings of the capitalist state as well, like the so-called justice system, we find that they've also played the role of more than willing collaborators with big mining capital. So this was like highly visible recently when a bunch of Stop Adani activists got fined $80,000 for shutting down the port at Abbott Point for a few hours. Compare this to the $18,000 that they got fined, that Adani got fined, $18,000, not million, for that huge coal spill that like went into the wetlands right next to the port. Absolutely devastated the environment. The courts have also consistently ruled against the Wangan and Jagalingu people, who have for years now been protesting against this mine. And actually, in the last few years, there's been 13 separate like court cases involving Adani with various groups opposing the mine. And so far, 12 of them have all been resolved in the company's favour. And there's one more outstanding, and it's probably going to swing Adani's way as well. Furthermore, there's rumours that Malcolm Turnbull is considering bringing in what Tony Abbott proposed a few years ago, which was a massive, basically removing the right of environmental groups to even contest mining developments under federal laws, unless they can show that they're directly affected. As for the police, well, their relationship with the mining industry, I think, is summed up pretty well by, sorry, I didn't have a slideshow today, but people might have seen out west in Queensland, they've got these police cars that have Santos on the side of them. Like, they've just been donated by the company. Yeah, but, like, you know, if people look at how crazy the police have been up north for the small number of, you know, brave activists who've been trying to protest the mine up there, they've been pretty brutal. And finally, the coal industry wouldn't be what it is today without the support of the public universities. So while they may be eager to prove their commitments to sustainability, these claims, to whatever extent they're actually valid, are entirely negated by the deep structural ties that they have with the fossil fuel companies. So, for example, the University of Queensland, the engineering faculty webpage boasts its formal connections with Rio Tinto, Xstrata, Newcrest, and Nihon Superior, and the University Senate there actually has a former Xstrata CEO on the board. Curtin University in WA recently launched a $116 million new facility called the Resources and Chemistry Precinct, which, in their own words, brings together university, industry and government. So, yeah, just to sum up that little section, the many facets of the Australian state are deeply committed to the coal industry, and likewise, the coal industry also has its tentacles deeply embedded in the state, which means that even if we could successfully combat some of the symptoms of the disease, like by stopping this mine and maybe a few others into the future, it still wouldn't have gotten rid of the root of the problem, which is that the institutions of Australian capitalism recognise that continuing to mine coal is vital to its long-term strategic interests. Alrighty. So on to the last part, what can we do about it? So as socialists, we look to the power of the working class to challenge the power of the bosses and to fight for a more decent society. So it's important for us to consider the role that the unions, who cover workers in the coal industry, can play in all of this. Certainly, they have a history of bitter struggles with the coal bosses. And in years past, the union movement in general has chalked up an impressive record of taking militant industrial action to protect the environment. However, sadly, this just isn't the case today. And it's partly due to the overall decline of the union movement, but it's also because of a regression in the politics of the unions. And case in point being the, I'm sorry to say, but woeful position of the CFMEU in favour of the Adani mine. This is despite the fact that the mine isn't going to create all these jobs for workers. Actually, it's probably only, if you read the Courier Mail, they say 10,000, but this is bullshit. Like, it's probably only going to create about 1,000 jobs, which even an expert Adani witness testified to in court. And to put that in context, there's 10,000 unemployed people in Townsville alone. Up in North Queensland. But yeah, as I said at the beginning of the talk, like, coal miners, the CFMU's members, are being killed by black lung, and this is actually getting worse. So it's actually just, like, I think quite terrible that they haven't taken a stand against this project. But I just wanted to talk a bit more about, like the power of the unions, like the latent power that exists in the coal industry today. There has been one unfortunate development, which has been open cut mining, which has really screwed over the CFMU's power. So the coal mines used to practically be closed shops. That was because, well, underground coal mining requires high levels of skill. It's an incredibly dangerous job. And so it kind of just made sense for workers. There was a greater impetus to get organised in the union. However, in the early 90s, the coal bosses had a really, explicit strategy of bringing in, open-cut mining. It's a way more alienated form of working. A lot of the workers just in a cab all day in a truck and don't even get to talk to each other. We've seen the setting up of, like, fly-in, fly-out camps. This has been absolutely terrible for union coverage. It's often impossible for union officials to even get onto the sites. And it's totally smashed up all, like, the once, you know, long-established coal communities that used to exist. Now they're just, like, extremely transient camps of workers. So all of that might make it seem like, well, you know, there's even it's even less likely that we could see union action in the industry. However, I just want to point out that I think it's been contradictory because as a couple of Socialist Alternative members who recently went up to take part of the blockade up in the Galilee Basin said, on the day that they locked onto the massive conveyor belt that loads all the coal onto the ships at Abbott Point, there were only 7 workers operating this massive machine which loads all the coal into the ports. So that's not a lot of workers you would need to unionise and to, you know, convince of some action to just immediately shut it down. Well, like, likewise, like, if just, like, one train driver just, like, stops the train, that's going to shut down, like, you know, production. It's going to grind everything to a halt. The company's going to lose millions of dollars. So I still think that the working class has a lot of latent power. If the Adani mine does go ahead, we obviously desire for not a single kilo of coal to leave Australia. But the truth is, like I said, that the union movement is just not in a state to enforce this at the moment. So what I think it's going to take first is the pressure of a mass protest movement. And that's something that I actually don't think we've seen yet. I don't know if people have been a part of, like, Stop Adani stuff, like, in their city or where they're from. But, like, I can tell you that in Brisbane, although it seems like so many people around the place are wearing these shirts or are doing their own kind of, like, little Stop Adani things, we just haven't even had a single mass central demonstration, and I think that's been a real weakness. And some positive examples that we can compare this to are, the first is the Franklin Dam dispute of 1983. So a lot of the history of that dispute focuses on the direct action that happened down in Tasmania at the dam site, which was significant. However, the thing that really put pressure on Bob Hawke to eventually override the Tasmanian government and stop that from going ahead were the large, loud and recurring rallies that happened in the capital cities, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, where they drew tens of thousands of people. The second example is the Bentley blockade, which happened near Lismore in northern New South Wales. Now, the Bentley blockade successfully pressured the New South Wales government to ban fracking in that area. And it actually was won through direct action. They, at the high point, they had a couple of thousand people down there at the direct action camp. Now, this is obviously a great struggle to learn from. However, I would argue that the situation with Adani today is very different. And the same is, unfortunately, probably not possible. Because unlike, Bentley, which is conveniently close drive to places like Lismore and Byron Bay, where we know there's a lot of people who would like to protest against, CSG... the Bowen Basin is, like, hundreds and hundreds of kilometres away. It costs a lot of money just to fly up there. It's in the middle of nowhere. And it's, obviously not near a metropolitan centre. So, while I think the direct action up north is important, I think that we need to back it up with big rallies in the cities like we've seen, like we saw in the Franklin Dam campaign. And if we manage to get that kind of thing happening, and I think it's totally possible, like, I was a part of, like, we had, like, a human sign recently up in Brisbane, like, where we all spelt out Stop Adani and a drone took a photo of all of us. In Brisbane, we got a couple thousand people to it, and it was in some, like, suburban, like, on a suburban football field in the middle of nowhere, and the trains were down that day, and 2,000 people still rocked up. So I was just like, God, if Stop Adani had just called, like, a big, you know, set-piece demonstration in the middle of the city, like, how many people would have actually turned up and, like, actually spent some time building it? And if we could get that kind of action happening, well, then I think that perhaps we could convince, you know, trade unions like the ETU, for example, which in recent years has put black bans on uranium and, like, taken a stand for the environment. Well, maybe we could get them to actually come out in opposition to this mine. Actually, there is another union which is against Adani at the moment, I know, which is the NTU, but it would be great, obviously, to see the blue-collar union starting to take that position as well. And I think it's that kind of action that could begin to really ratchet up the pressure on the Labor Party. Like, clearly Bill Shorten is not opposed to the Adani coal mine at all. He's just, got some mealy-mouthed points of objection to save his ass, to save his ass in Batman recently, the Labor Party. But, yeah, it was all totally disingenuous. But, that's the kind of mass action I think we're going to need. Just to wrap things up. How am I going for time? Yeah, cool. Just to wrap things up, look, I hope if you've taken anything out of the talk today, one thing I really tried to emphasise was just, like, how structurally embedded, like, deep down, like a tick, like the coal industry is in Australia. And it's going to take a hell of a lot of struggle to extricate it. I think, particularly the way that it's tied into the strategic interests of Australian capitalism at this period in time and looking at what's happening around the rest of the world, there's just no way that they're going to sacrifice the export industry for coal. It's way too important to them. Even if we can get renewable energy for the domestic market, they're not going to stop exporting coal. You can see that in the way that the capitalist state just absolutely backs it to the hilt. I think that, unfortunately, the union movement is not in a position at the moment to lead this struggle, but that's where I think that people like us in this room, I know there's, like, a lot of student activists in here from all around the country. There is actually, like, we're planning, like, the students at least are planning some, protests, national protests against the Adani mine soon, and I think we really need to, like, start pushing that kind of action if we're going to stop this mine.